We're going to continue the series we began last week in the Song of Solomon, and I'd ask you to turn to chapter 2. As you're doing that, I want to open us up in a word of prayer. Our Heavenly Father, as we embark this evening on continuing this series, continuing our study of this very challenging book, the Song of Solomon, our prayer is that you'll open our minds to what you have for us there, enable us to understand it, enable us to see the implications for our lives and for our worldview on this issue of sexuality. We pray these things in Christ's name. Amen. Now, we did chapter 1 last week and just kind of began chapter 2, and I spent some amount of time talking about different interpretations, different approaches to the Song of Solomon, and then we did some exegesis. What I had suggested was that the better view, and there's several different versions of this, but the better view is probably that the song should be understood not as an allegory, but in a somewhat literalistic way, with the caveat that it is a song, S-O-N-G, a song. It is Hebrew poetry, so it's full of figures of speech that are not in any way intended to literally speak to what the words say, in the sense that, for example, she will refer to her garden. She's not talking about vegetables. I mean, it's that sort of thing. But we understand that while it uses poetic language, it really literally is speaking of a love affair. There's a lot of debate about whether Solomon wrote the book, whether the characters in the book are the real Solomon or someone else under that name. What I have suggested is that Solomon did write it, that contemporaneous Egyptian poetry reflects the same sorts of themes and motifs as what Solomon wrote. It's a helpful indicator that this sort of literature could have been written at the time. Whether it historically actually happened, whether there really was this lady Shulamit and Solomon had a marriage with her, or whether he's merely writing a song about marriage, is less than certain. And frankly, not all that important at the end of the day that you tie it down whether it was historical fact or not. But the song does claim to be written by Solomon, and he seems to figure as a character within the song. Some would suggest, and they could be right, that it uses Solomon as a character because of who he is. He is the royal persona par excellence. But regardless of all of that, the gist of what's being conveyed will come out of this, whether we believe it was historical, whether we believe Solomon had a romance with this lady Shulamit. It is presented to us as if he wrote it, as if he is a character within it. And what's very important, too, is that she takes the lead, and we'll see that throughout, and we'll see more of that in chapter 2. She is, in many ways, the more prominent voice in the singing that goes on here. And there are other characters, and I'm saying characters in a sort of generalized sense. Sometimes Shulamit will speak or sing, sometimes Solomon, sometimes a chorus, sometimes a narrator, and one could argue that the narrator is really the chorus. We can't be dogmatic about it, but I'll show you today where it seems like a narrator speaks. And then the brothers will come in at the end of the book in the sort of finishing off of the story. There is a story. It's not chronological. But when you take the whole song as in its completion, there's a story that gets told about this lady Shulamit, about her childhood, about her brothers, her family, her marriage, and of course about her union with Solomon. So we begin in chapter 2, verse 1. Now, I covered a little of this last time, but just to sort of start at the beginning, she is speaking, and I have suggested, and we'll just remind you, because it's very helpful as we study through this, you cannot be absolutely dogmatic about who speaks, because it does not say, in general, Solomon said, Shulamit said, the chorus said. You glean from context who is speaking. Most of the time, you can be relatively certain. Sometimes it's a little difficult. She is speaking in chapter 2, verse 1. In fact, she began speaking in chapter 1, verse 16, when she said, "Behold, thou art fair, my beloved, yea, pleasant, also our bed is green," and she continues speaking. And she continues speaking or singing in chapter 2, verse 1, when she says, "I am the rose of Sharon," and I'll just stop there. As I mentioned before, there's a famous song, a hymn, that speaks of the rose of Sharon, the lily of the valleys. It's an outstanding hymn. It's theologically just incorrect because it's not the male character. It's not Solomon singing or describing himself. It is the female character describing herself. And we think, well, she says she's a rose, she's a lily of the valleys. A lily is a common thing. And the response to her saying she's the lily of the valleys is the response of her lover, Solomon, who says, you're not just one lily among many. He says, in fact, in verse 2, where he speaks, as the lily among thorns, so is my love among the daughters. Okay? She's as a lily among thorns. In his eyes, unlike in her perception that she's just one lily among many, she really is the only lily and all the others are thorns. That's his building her up. And it says among the daughters. The daughters is a reference to the daughters of Jerusalem. I'll come back to them in a moment, but they're referenced multiple times in the song, and we'll come back to them in a moment. But essentially, they are the chorus. They are the young ladies who provide some of the narration, and in certain places in the song, they're the young ladies that are given instruction. This is wisdom literature. The Jewish people in their Bible, which is not organized the same way as the Christian Bible, viewed this as wisdom literature. And in fact, the Song of Solomon is one of the five songs that are one of the five books of the Old Testament that are read during the Jewish feast. This one, as I recall, is read at the Passover. Doesn't seem to have a clear connection, but I'm just telling you that's the tradition. But they view it as wisdom literature. If it's wisdom literature, you have to say, what's the wisdom and who is it written to? And we'll see that. It's going to come up here in a moment. So Solomon says, you're a lily among thorns. So is my love among the daughters. In other words, the daughters of Jerusalem, those other girls, the ones he did not marry, they're mere thorns, and she is the lily. He has taken a common picture of her and made her uncommon. Then in verse 3, she will respond to him as the apple tree among the trees of the wood. There's a lot of trees in the forest, but the apple tree is fruitful, so it stands out. She sort of returns the favor. He says, you're a lily among thorns, and she says, you're an apple tree among a whole bunch of pine trees, something to that effect. If you can understand how she's responding, they're playing off one another's words, and it makes sense. He's an apple tree among the trees of the wood. She will speak often of in terms of imagery of fruitfulness, of lush foliage, gardens, that sort of thing. It permeates the ancient Egyptian poetry. It permeates this book, and it's all intended to convey sexual imagery. He's the apple tree among the trees of the wood. So is my beloved among the sons. I think he described who she is among the daughters of Jerusalem. So is my beloved, she says, among the sons of Jerusalem by implication. She elevates him above all the rest. She says, I sat down under his shadow with great delight, and his fruit was sweet to my taste. This, along with a number of other things she'll say later, and he will, are poetic language to infer their sexual experience. And it's never done in a crass or detailed way, the way some will take this book as sort of a manual. It's never done that way. It's always poetic. It's like in the old shows, if they wanted to infer that this was going to happen, you saw them embrace and somebody closed the door and you didn't see anything else. That's what the Song of Solomon does generally. Now, it will get a little bit of graphic, and we'll see it in a moment, but always at a very poetic level, as it is here. His fruit, right, which is apples. He's an apple tree. His fruit is pleasurable to taste. She's talking about enjoying their lovemaking. Verse 4 makes that clear. He brought me to the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. That's in the King James. The banqueting house is the place of where the wine is. Now, she will say things about wine. Do you recall something in the first chapter about wine? Chapter 1, verse 2, what she said? Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth for thy love. And as I suggested last week, love almost always in this book should be translated lovemaking. She says it's better than wine. So wine is associated with having a good time, enjoying oneself, a sort of intoxicating pleasure, which she is assigning to her physical romance with him. And so she says here in chapter 2 that he brought her to the banqueting house. They're not going to the liquor store. They're not. But she uses poetic language, poetic imagery, for him bringing her to a place where they could engage in lovemaking. His banner over me was love. Okay, love making. What would a new translation say instead of banner? Because we think of banner, we imagine some kind of flag flying over. And go ahead.
The verse says, he brought me to the banquet hall and looked on me with love.
Yes. The banner is, it expresses intent. And so in newer translations, it's the focus or the intent that's in view, which is the love making. And that's what she says. And then she continues in verse 5, stay me or satisfy me, she says, with flagons. And there's an old word you don't hear anymore. It's raisin cakes. Newer translations will pick up something to that effect. Raisin cakes. Stay me with raisin cakes. Comfort me with apples. Remember, he's the apple tree. She's not eating. That's not the point. See, it's all poetic. But it's not about food. For I am, in the King James, I love it because it says sick of love. And, you know, in our modern day, we would think, well, why? What's your problem? You seemed happy a word or two ago. Lovesick. I am lovesick. Meaning, she wants more, right? That's what she's saying. I'm lovesick. And in verse 5 and verse 6 makes it very explicit what she's talking about, how she's using the imagery of eating the apples and all that, not to describe any specific act, but just the experience of lovemaking in a very general sense is described. In verse 6, his left hand is under my head, and his right hand doth embrace me. Well, that means they're laying down, right? Almost certainly. And that's where she gets there. And then verse 7, she says, and we're going to park here for a moment, I charge you. Now she's talking to the chorus. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose and by the hinds of the field, that you stir not up nor awake my love till he please. Now there's a translation issue we'll struggle with, but let's unpack this verse. This verse captures one of the key teachings of the book. If you said, what's the wisdom that she offers the daughters of Jerusalem in this book? This one's it. And it's going to be repeated two more times. But this is a key verse throughout the book, Song of Solomon. First of all, let's talk about the animals. Just like the vegetation and the trees are used and the lilies and the roses for various imagery, either of physical appearance or to associate with lovemaking, so also with the animal imagery. Remember last time, chapter 1, he described her having the beauty of one of Pharaoh's horses, pulling his chariots because they would bedazzle the horses, if we can use a modern word for it. And he described her in that way. So here, she says that she charges them by the rose, R-O-E-S, and by the hinds, H-A-N-D-S, King James words. Let's fast forward in time. What are the animals mentioned in the New Translation?
Gazelles and wild does.
Yeah, gazelles and it says wild does? Interesting, okay. Anyone have one different? Usually, hinds? Yeah, well, mine has hinds. What some of them will say, another translation I had read, and I think, I'm trying to remember what translation it was. It may have been the Holman Christian or the NET Bible. The roe is a gazelle. Now, the gazelle, if you've seen them, they're the ones that have the little straight-up horns. They're not real, real large, but when you spook them like that, you see them on the Nature Channel or something, when that animal starts coming, they're very graceful, but they're very fast. They just spook away and sprint away real quickly. And then the hart, H-A-R-T, or the hind, is a young male deer. Is what it would seem to be. And so just with that in mind, let's think about what she says when she charges the daughters of Jerusalem, the chorus, all the marriageable aged young ladies in the city, except her, because she's the one that got to marry this one. She charges them by the rose and the hinds, or by the young male deer and the gazelles of the field, that you stir not up. That's to wake up, to arouse, she says, nor awake, and the King James has the word my love, but my is not in the text. And it's been added to smooth it out, except it changes the reading and it's not correct. She says, don't wake up lovemaking, and they've added till he pleases, and it should say basically till it's time is what it should say. Yeah, don't stir or awaken essentially passions until the appropriate time. Right, that is what she says to the daughters of Jerusalem. Let me say something about the daughters of Jerusalem. They are addressed in a number of places. Of course, we saw them in chapter 2, verse 1, but we also would see them in chapter 1, verse 5, chapter 2, verse 7, 3, verse 5, 3, verses 10 to 11, chapter 5, verses 8 and 16, chapter 6, verse 9, and chapter 8, verse 4. That's a lot of references to the daughters of Jerusalem. They're quite prominent as a sort of character, a sort of backdrop in this story. And this admonition in 2:7, turn for a moment to 3, verse 5, and look at the admonition there. Again, she'll be speaking, the female character, Shulamit. She says, "I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose and by the hinds of the field, that you stir not up, nor awake love, till he please," or really until it's time. That's chapter 3, verse 5. And then in chapter 8, verse 4, near the end of the song, the last chapter, 8, verse 4, "I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that you stir not up, nor awake my love until he pleases." Again, the same admonition. Again, the translation's a little off, but the same admonition all three times. In fact, the book sort of culminates in chapter 8 with that admonition, and then there's sort of an epilogue to the song that will follow. This is the key wisdom teaching of the book. It's not the only teaching of the book, but it is the key wisdom teaching of the book to the young ladies. And very simply, she is saying to them that they should not be sexually aroused until the proper time and the proper person arises. They are to look at her romance with Solomon in the book as sort of the exemplar of what has happened, because she has waited until the proper time and the proper person has come along, and this has led to a more fulfilling experience. That is her basic wisdom to the young unmarried ladies of the city of Jerusalem, and by implication of the nation. So verse 8, she continues, "The voice of my beloved, behold, he comes leaping upon the mountains, skipping upon the hills." Now, think about the animal she just mentioned, the young deer, the gazelle. She pictures him leaping upon the mountains and the hills, as it is jumping from one mountaintop to another. We call that superpowers. It's poetic. Just like the apple tree isn't really an apple tree, it's a symbol for him. Now he's being symbolized by this animal with its grace and its speed. There is something I'll read to you. This may just bring a little more richness to part of this. The gazelle symbolizes the swiftness of a lover coming to his beloved. 2 Samuel 2:18 actually refers to a gazelle to make a comparison to a person. But this is something I wanted to read from the Egyptian literature. I said last week that Egyptian love poetry that was contemporaneous with the Song of Solomon had similar themes. In fact, it had a lot of similarities. And in this one, I'm actually going to quote just a line or two from 3,000-year-old Egyptian poetry that came off of papyrus. "Oh, that you came..." Let me start over. "Oh, that you came to your sister swiftly like a bounding gazelle. Its feet feel its limbs are weary. Terror has entered its body. A hunter pursues with his hounds. They do not see its dust. It sees a resting place as a trap. It takes the river as its road." Then he kind of changes the direction a little. "May you find her hiding place before your hand is kissed four times. Pursue your sister's love. The golden gives her to you, my friend." You see, in the beginning of this Egyptian poetry, "Oh, that you came to your sister swiftly like a bounding gazelle." That's a gazelle bouncing over the hilltops. The use of sister seems odd to us, but when we get into this book, we're going to find that Solomon calls her his sister. And she's not his blood sister, but it's a common expression of one's female lover in that ancient literature, in the Egyptian literature and here in Solomon's writing. And it almost views the gazelle running with the fierceness and the wherewithal of one being hunted. And then it returns to the idea that the gazelle is merely seeking his lover. And he says that you'll find her before you've been kissed four times. He says to pursue her. This is from a work called Three Poems in the Papyrus Chester Beatty I collection. These things weren't just on the bookstore that you would go to, but they're there, and they're really an eye-opener into the fact that this book, Song of Solomon, absolutely is consistent with the literature of the time, although much more complex, but the imagery is there. And those who would doubt it and say, well, it was written much later, Solomon couldn't have written it, are off base with that. Well, here he is, leaping on the mountaintop, skipping upon the hills. Why? He's coming to get her. And verse 9, my beloved is like a roe or a young hart. In other words, a young deer or a gazelle. Behold, he stands behind our wall. He looks forth at the window, showing himself through the lattice. She visualizes herself within a room, and he's arrived there to meet her. And there's a lattice work behind him, and he looks through the lattice work, and he sees her, and she sees his face, through the lattice, just we can imagine the lattice. And she says in verse 10, my beloved spake and said unto me. This makes it easy to know that the speaker's going to change, because it says, he spake and said unto me. In verse 10, second half, now Solomon will speak through the end of verse 14. And Solomon says, rise up, my love, my fair one, and come away. So he's leapt over the mountaintops. He comes outside her room. He looks through the lattice way. She sees him. He says, arise. That means get out of bed or whatever, get off the couch, whatever she's doing, and come away with me. He invites her to come away. For lo, he says in verse 11, the winter is past. In fact, 11 through 13 will picture the arrival of spring. You can expect that the air smells different as things are blooming. The temperature is warmer, the animals are out, the birds are singing, all that stuff. It starts to paint a sort of romantic background for the chase. And that's what he invites her to. He says, for lo, the winter is past. The rain is over and gone. Now, what do the animals and the plants do when the winter's past? And don't make this hard, right? When the winter's past and the warm weather comes again, they all start to bloom and to grow, and the squirrels are having little baby squirrels, right? That's why the imagery is what it is. And that's what he is inviting her to when he says winter's past. I don't know if it's literally winter. See, that's where we get in trouble. We want to make everything literally winter. It doesn't matter. It's the point is that the time now is the time, he says, to have our passions awakened, which, again, what did she just say in verse 7? You wait until the right person in the right time. And he's saying, winter's past and it's spring. It is the right time, and he is the right person. So, for lo, the winter is past, the rain is over and gone, the flowers appear on the earth, the time of the singing of birds is come, and the voice of the turtle, that means turtle dove, is heard in our land. Hey, the birds are singing. It's a timing issue, and it matches what she had just said about wisdom. He goes on, he says, the fig tree puts forth her green figs. Pictures of fertility of the vegetation is part of the symbolism that runs throughout the entire song. He says, and the vines with the tender grape give a good smell. Well, what happens when the figs are ready? The vine is giving a good smell. Well, you harvest the fruit. Huh?
So you pick them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. You harvest the fruit, okay? And it's using that as a sort of poetic way of saying that there will be lovemaking. That's basically it. So he says, arise, my love, my fair one, and come away. That's his invitation. All those verses up to 13, from the second half of verse 10 through 13, he's awakening her. He's having her arise to come to him because of the time. He makes this invitation. He says, now's the time. Verse 14, oh, my dove, he calls her a dove, and he will do this again later. Now, he said before she looked like a horse. Now he's calling her a bird. What gives? All right. Well, remember, ancient literature, ancient images that in their time work. It's not a how-to manual, and it's not giving you, pickup lines or whatever. At some point, he will speak of her hair looking like the hair of a goat and that sort of thing. But just put it in the context, and it being 3,000 years old, she is his dove. And I think he has in mind especially her eyes, and he'll return to that later. But he says here, oh, my dove, Thou art in the clefts of the rock. No bird could go up high in the air, especially in this part of the world, and get up in a cleft of a rock and be inaccessible from anyone who would try to trap the bird. And he paints a picture here for a moment of her inaccessibility. And certainly when he's outside the lattice work and she's on the other side of the lattice in the room, she is inaccessible from him. And so he paints that picture. She is his dove, but she might as well be in the cleft of the rock because he can't reach out and embrace her. And that's what he says here. My dove, thou art in the clefts of the rock. In the secret places of the stairs, let me see thy countenance. I don't know what he sees through the lattice work, but he would just for one moment to see her face. He's laying it on pretty thick. He says, let me hear your voice, for sweet is your voice, and your countenance, your facial expression is comely or beautiful. And so the point is, right, he has invited her because spring has come. He's viewing her through the lattice, so he sees a sort of image of her, but not all that he would like to see and not with the clarity. And he invites her away and he says, I just want to see your face. I want to hear your voice. This could be a reunion after he's been gone for some time. This could, and probably more likely, is tied up with the fact that in part of the song she sings as one who has already gotten married and they've had their union. And in part of it, she reflects back to before that. And I suspect this may reflect back before that to him basically saying, you know, there's a time when you can't, and now there's a time of a new season has come when they can consummate their marriage.
So could this chronologically possibly be, you know, in traditional weddings at the time, they were a spouse, but then one day he would come and pick up his bride?
That's absolutely correct. And in fact, that's fixing to happen. It's actually going to play that out here in a moment. And so I think maybe this could be a remembering back as possible of before the marriage. It's definitely not a chronological song, and that can throw us off. So we'll see that in a moment. She's going to see him coming in the distance to pick her up so that the inaccessibility will be gone and they can finally be united, as you would expect in any love song with a happy ending. Verse 15, she begins speaking again, and she will speak through the end of chapter 3, verse 5. You'll see as she goes through why it seems to be her that's speaking and not him. But again, it doesn't tell you that in the text that the speaker has changed. You have to glean it as we can from verse 16. But she says in verse 15, take us the foxes, the little foxes that spoil the vines, for our vines have tender grapes. Verse 15 could still be Solomon speaking, but it seems more likely that it's her speaking to him about partaking of her pleasures. Now, I will say that verse 15 has been used, and I used to take it this way, as a teaching that within a marriage, as with a vineyard that would be symbolic of the marriage, the little foxes come and the little things, and if you don't deal with them and get the little foxes out of the way, that they become very big problems. And that's a good teaching, but I don't think it's here because this is all poetry. There really was never a real apple tree or a real gazelle or a real mountaintop, right? And so here, why would there be a real vineyard necessarily? But a vineyard is an image that she understands because we'll learn later it seems like she worked a vineyard. That was her job as a young person. And I think when the vineyard begins to harvest the grapes, the little foxes come. It's just a sign of the spring season. Just as he invited her and said, winter's past, spring has come, she responds and affirms that spring has indeed come because you're starting to see the little baby foxes out there trying to get them little grapes. She's not worried about getting rid of the foxes. She's saying it's springtime, which she looks forward to. Uh-huh.
She says here in the end of 15 in my translation, for the vineyards are in bloom.
Exactly. The King James says tender grapes, they're in bloom. It's ready for the harvest, and the harvest will be symbolic of their physical union. And that is most likely the significance of verse 15, as opposed to the writer suddenly shifting to a literal vineyard and a literal fox and saying, let's deal with the foxes in the relationship. That's good teaching. I just don't think it's here in this verse. And contextually, they're still dealing with the fact that winter's just passed and now spring has come. It's approaching the time when they will be married completely and consummate their marriage, which you'll see in a moment. Verse 16, she says, "My beloved is mine and I am his. He feeds among the lilies." That's how I know she's talking and not him. Now, what did she say she was earlier? Chapter 2, verse 1, "The rose of Sharon, the lily of the valleys." And he said, "You're a lily among thorns." Now she says, "He feeds among the lilies." Right? I mean, the expression, the use of the language kind of ties the song together. But she's talking about the physical union, okay, the lovemaking, as they are almost throughout the whole song. And she will say in different places the notion of him coming into her garden, something to that effect. Her partaking of his fruit as he's the apple tree. Don't make it something it's not. It's just their physical romance. Verse 17 says, "Until the day breaks," okay, until morning time, "until the shadows flee away," she says, "turn, my beloved, and be like a roe or a young hart upon the mountains of Bether." We'll unpack it a little bit. Again, similar imagery keeps occurring. The same animals, the gazelle, the young deer that leaps on the mountaintops. A picture in the ancient world and in the Egyptian poetry that I had read from earlier of the swiftness, the virility of the lover coming to her. And she says to him, as she had just said in the prior verse, "feed among the lilies," she now says, "be like a roe or young hart upon the mountains of Bether." Anyone have a different translation about the mountains of Bether?
Yeah, mine says on the divided mountains.
That's what it means. And King James makes it sound like it's a place. Now, I'm trying to be careful in how I say this. You don't have to push it too far to get what she's saying. Okay, she has just said he feeds among the lilies. She's asked him to be like this imagery of the animal that speed and grace and strength and all these things. And then she says, you know, be like that, she says, upon the divided mountain. She speaks, as she will later, and so will he, of her breast. And in chapter 3, verse 1, she says, "By night on my bed I sought him whom my soul loves." And you're like, well, what does that have to do with verse 17? It's a song, and it's not sequential. So we have to kind of take it in pieces, and I think this is why there's a chapter break here. It sort of finishes a thought in verse 17 as winter became spring, and they were able to unite physically. And now she's thinking back on what led to this time when winter would become spring. And she thinks back of a time when she thought of her love as she was in bed, and so she began to dream. Dreams are something the Bible deals with a lot. Sometimes prophets get a dream or a vision. But in the Song of Solomon, she will have a couple of episodes where she has similarly themed dreams that will reflect what she is thinking and feeling emotionally in the song. "By night on my bed I sought him whom my soul loves. I sought him, but I found him not." Verses 1 through 4 are somewhat symbolic, I think, of the struggle between her desire, looking forward to being married to him, uniting in marriage, consummating the marriage, and her recognition of the importance of her own purity, which she comes back to as a theme several times, and admonishes the daughters of Jerusalem about this purity issue. And so here she is on her bed thinking about him. He's not there. And in her dream, or in her mind when she's thinking about it, it reflects the fact that he's not there. And she longs to be with him. And in fact, what she does in verse 2 is she, and this is why I think it's a dream, she leaves her bed and she runs around in the streets trying to find him. If her lover, and I'm now just using that in the sense of like her betrothed, if he is Solomon, he shouldn't be hard to find. And what you'll see in this dream, and especially in the next one, is that the reaction of the characters in the dream doesn't fit the reality. And dreams are often like that. It seems real when you're dreaming it. Then when you wake up, you're like, that's the most dumb thing ever. Why, you know, the older I get, the less I remember of dreams. But usually, if I remember any bit of it, it actually doesn't make rational sense. But when you're asleep, it makes rational sense. I'm just saying. And then you wake up and, you know, I used to have this recurring dream. I would wake up and I was still at work. The worst dream you can have is the dream you're still at work. And so you wake up and you were dreaming that whatever you do for a living is what you were doing. And so now it's like, my goodness, it's 3 a.m. Do I get paid for the last 3 hours? Because of my dream, I've been working those last 3 hours. But it doesn't make any rational sense. That's just how it is. Well, she goes in this dream, and she says in verse 2, I will rise now and go about the city in the streets and in the broad ways. So she's going to walk around the streets in the middle of the night. I will seek him whom my soul loves. She's looking for Solomon. I sought him, but I found him not. This is all in her dream. But it reflects her longing to be together with him. Why isn't she together with him? Because it's not the right time. As she reflects back on it, remember that ultimately she wants to give this admonition to the young ladies in Jerusalem about timing of this. And so she says in verse 3, the watchmen that go about the city found me. Well, if she were in Jerusalem, and it doesn't say it's Jerusalem, but if she were, there would be watchmen, there would be guards, and if she's out walking around at 3 a.m., they may be asking her what she's doing. It's not like Houston where there's city lights everywhere. There certainly would be lamps, but here you've got a young lady walking around in the dark, again, in a dream, but you could expect that the night guards might catch you and say, what are you doing, right? That happens nowadays. You walk around the right place in the middle of the night, and the police are going to show up and ask you what you're doing. The watchmen that go about the city, they found me. To whom I said, now she asked them a question, saw you him whom my soul loves? Now, it may well be that this sort of is a like an authority motif. Remember, again, she was separated from him by distance because he had to travel to her, by the lattice work. She's on the other side. He says, I need to hear your voice, see your face. The seasons are changing. Now she has a dream. She's not with him. She dreams of being with him, but she's not. She goes to look for him in the streets. She can't find him. Then she gets stopped by the guards. It's sort of a barrier, a boundary, an authority figure. It's a possibility. Uh-huh.
Well, it seems like a role reversal here because instead of the guards stopping her, she seems to stop him.
She does. The fact that she's met with them maybe as an authority figure, they're going to come back later. And see, the thing is, when she comes back to these people later in her dream, they beat her in the dream. Again, not rational. Who's going to take Solomon's girl and beat her, right? Not rational. But within the dream, they present a sort of authority. But you're right. She asked them, just as in the first chapter, remember, he was the sheep herder and she wanted to go in the daytime and find him. See, again, you have the theme of separation, which is why she could be sick of love, right? Longing to be with him, and that's what happens here. And so in verse 4, it was but a little that I passed from them, but I found him whom my soul loves. Now she finds him. And look what she does. Now remember, this is in her dream. It's not really happening. This is kind of weird. We're in a song that's poetic, so a lot of things aren't literal. They're symbolic. But within the poetry, within the song, she has a dream. What does she do in her dream? She gets what she most desires, to finally be married. This is a young lady who's betrothed. She's looking forward to that time period. And when she's finally married, they can have their union. And she is here saying that she found him. And she says further. And again, we're going to pause here in a moment and think about the implications of this. But look what she says here. It was but a little while that I passed from them, that is the guards, and I found him whom my soul loves. I held him, and I would not let him go. This is interesting because the Hebrew word for here, for I held him, it is a special word. It is to seize a person by force and to hold them so tightly that they cannot break loose. She's not saying I gave him a bear hug or put my arms around him to embrace him. She says, I ain't letting go. Again, in her dream, because she so longed for him that she would search in the night to find him. And now she embraces him in a way that he can never leave her again. Then it says, I would not let him go. That's to give up your grasp of something. Until I had brought him into my mother's house and into the chamber of her that conceived me. This is a hard verse. Let me finish verse 5 and then we'll back up and unpack verse 4. Verse 5 brings us sort of in a circle to where we were earlier. Remember in chapter 2, she had spoken in verse 7 to the chorus. She gave her wisdom to them not to awaken love until the proper time. And she says that again in chapter 3, verse 5. I charge you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the rose and by the hinds of the field. Okay? Those will maybe be a reference to all the other young marriageable men out there. And she says to these young ladies that you stir not up nor awake love until it's time. Don't awake the passions of love, and she's speaking of physical romance, until the right time. And again, you've got this song unfolding, you've got this sort of storyline that's not quite sequential, but the song is very specific about a timing when they can come together, and then she gives her instruction to the daughters. Now, verse 4, turn over to chapter 8, verse 5 for a moment. Chapter 8 brings the whole thing full circle. This is a hard verse. There's a lot of debate about this verse, and chapter 8, verse 5 will help us answer it. The Bible usually answers the questions it raises as we go through it. Look at chapter 8, verse 4, first of all. We saw this one earlier. See what she says? I charge you, daughters of Jerusalem, that you stir not up nor awake love until it's time. Okay, kind of my paraphrase. That's what we just read. And then in chapter 8, verse 5, who is this that comes up from the wilderness leaning upon her beloved? See how it asks the question of who's coming up from the wilderness leaning on her beloved? Go back for a moment, just for a moment, to chapter 3, verse 6, the very next verse we hadn't read yet. Who is this that comes up out of the wilderness like pillars of smoke? You see, songs in modern times have choruses, not in the same sense that this song has a chorus, words that get repeated. Right? This is a song, and it will return several times over to certain key language. And these things are all tied together. The admonition to the young daughters of Jerusalem, the sort of rhetorical question, who is this that comes in the distance as one sees one's lover approach? And then this issue about the mother's house. That's the hard part. So back in chapter 8, verse 5, we read on. After she says, who is this that comes from the wilderness, leaning upon her beloved, that's the chorus speaking in chapter 8, verse 5, the first part of the verse. Then she speaks and answers the chorus. The chorus says, who is it? And young Shulamit answers the chorus in chapter 8, verse 5. I raised thee up under the apple tree. There my mother brought thee forth. I'm sorry, I read that wrong. There thy mother brought thee forth. There she brought thee forth that bare thee. This is a bizarre thing to us in our culture. Why the focus on the place where Solomon's mother conceived him? All right? And you know, it's difficult to fully grasp this, and again, 3,000 years later, the story will come full circle as she will unite with him back in chapter 3 in the place of her conception. And she will unite with him again in chapter 8 in the place of his conception. There's an ancient thought, it seems, a sort of circle of life pattern where the place where a person was conceived and she comes again with her lover in that same place. That's what happens in 8:5, and we'll get to it in a few weeks. Back here in chapter 3, verse 5, it's the same language, the same idea in chapter 3, verse 4 and 5, rather. In chapter 3, verse 4, she says, I brought him into my mother's house, into the chamber, that's the bedroom, of her that conceived me. And this is one of those things, I think it's an ancient idea that just doesn't resonate with a modern counterpart, but there's an emphasis not only on the act that they do, but the place. And whether they really went there, I don't know. But I just know that the language, all the language right here in chapter 3, gets repeated roughly in chapter 8. That's why I showed you that. And in both places, in the midst of it, there's this concept of their union occurring in the place where they themselves had originally been conceived. So that's the expression. Now, I can't tell you why that's real important to her. And the scholars don't seem to have a grip on it, but that's just the fact of what we understand from this, is that this was important to her, and that's where the union happens. And so think about it, how it fits in the story, though. In the story, she wants, in the next verse, to admonish the children of Jerusalem, the daughters of Jerusalem, about the right time, the right person, and even, in some sense, for her, the right place. the emphasizing again that the timing, and so she tells them not to awaken passions before it's right. Then in verse 6, the speaker will again be the chorus, and the chorus asks the question, who is this that comes out of the wilderness? Just like the question in chapter 8 that the chorus will ask. But here, when they ask the question, it's only Solomon. And in chapter 8, it's her and Solomon together. Okay? And so they connect, but here he comes alone to fetch his bride, and later they come as a married couple, and the chorus is drawing our attention to the fact that they are no longer separated. She has waited until the appointed time and so forth, so that they come together. Who is this that comes out of the wilderness like pillars of smoke, perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all powders of the merchant? It pictures Solomon's dramatic arrival. And this could be a narrator or it could be the chorus, and I'll just go with saying it's the chorus speaking. I think they can actually smell the fragrance. Again, it's poetic, but they smell the fragrance approaching as this entourage, for lack of a better term, comes in the distance. And the chorus gets our attention as the one who would observe the song played out on a stage and says, who is this that comes? And we all stand and we look with this young lady and we look out to see who comes, and it paints the imagery first with a sense of smell because it's in the distance, but we can already smell the pleasant odors, and these perfumes, of course, are very expensive. They're the stuff of rich folks. Behold his bed in verse 7, which is Solomon's 70 valiant men are about it, that's 60 soldiers, of the valiant of Israel. Put off the significance of bed for a moment, but as you can imagine, if Solomon travels, there's going to be an entourage, and there's going to be soldiers. There's going to be soldiers around him. So she, in the song, sings of the approaching soldiers. They all hold swords, being experts in war. Every man has a sword upon his thigh because of the fear in the night. Because bandits, right? And then in verse 9, King Solomon made himself a chariot of the wood of Lebanon. Now this is a sort of translation issue with the King James, with a difficult term. The word in verse 9 in the King James, it's chariot, could often be a bridal litter, a bridal carrier for a young lady that they would put her in there. There's references to that in the Jewish Mishnah, a Jewish writing that was finished after the first century, but very early in time. Yes?
My translation says a sedan, which gives the impression of basically a wagon that's carrying his royalty.
Exactly. That's what I was going to say. So new translations like the Holman Christian, the NET Bible, we'll say a sedan. The NET says sedan chair, or, and if I'm saying this word right, a palanquin. It's the word, and you see it on the movies, you know, where you've got men that are carrying a sort of coach. It's not drawn by horses. It's drawn by people, and they carry it. And in the middle, you've got the king sitting there. And this may have been done in certain ceremonies to get the bride and bring her to her husband, although here it pictures Solomon coming to her. And we would expect Solomon to be traveling as royalty. And so he is in this song. And so chariot is not quite the right word. A sedan chair, which even then is not a word we would use often, but a sort of chair that's carried by people to convey royalty. Verse 10 describes the richness of this chair, likely created for this occasion. This is her, I think, seeing the royal wedding procession come to get her. Again, not a sequential song in terms of timing. She's already spoken of their physical union. Now she's looking back in time to him coming to her. And he wouldn't need the big procession if they were already married. This is him coming to fetch his bride, most likely. He made the pillars of this sort of coach that he's traveling on, he's made them of silver. These are the post of the coach. They're made of silver. The bottom, or the back of the coach, is gold. This probably wood overlaid with gold, so you understand, just like in the Old Testament, the Ark of the Covenant was made of wood, but it was covered with gold. And so these things have been, wood has been covered with silver or gold. That was common in the ancient world. He says the covering of it, that's the interior, you're going to love it. The interior is purple, color of royalty. throughout the Bible. In the New Testament, there's a wealthy lady that helps found the church in Philippi. Her name is Lydia. She was a seller of fine purple fabric. We'll meet her in the book of Acts in a few weeks. The covering of it was purple. In the midst thereof, being paid with love, and my King James says, for the daughters of Jerusalem, but it should be by the daughters of Jerusalem. That is, it gives us the idea that the interior of the coach is, in new translations, we'll actually say with leather. That it's been covered with leather by the daughters of Jerusalem themselves. Verse 11, go forth, you daughters of Zion. Remember, it's the daughters of Jerusalem or the daughters of Zion that ask the question in verse 6, who is this? Now they get a response to them, to the question, or directive from the question. They say, go forth, O you daughters of Zion, and behold King Solomon. Because this verse 11 speaks to the daughters of Jerusalem, some would say that really from 6 to 11 is a sort of narrator who speaks, and it could be. These are things I just wouldn't fight about, but it ain't Solomon talking, it ain't Shulamit talking, so it's either a narrator or the chorus themselves. Could be a narrator. The narrator then would be the one asking the question, and then the narrator would be telling or instructing the chorus, the young ladies of Jerusalem, to go out. And he says here in verse 11, go forth, you daughters of Zion, or same as you daughters of Jerusalem, behold King Solomon, with the crown wherewith his mother crowned him in the day of his espousals. Espousals is your wedding vows, the day you do your vows. He says, you know, behold, you know, Solomon crowned by his mother in the day of his espousals and in the day of the gladness of his heart. You see, what has happened is, I think, is that he's been given this crown by his mother, a sort of gift for his wedding. And he's come on the coach to pick up his bride, and he's seen with his entourage in the distance, wearing his crown. He's got the new coat that's been specially made to pick her up. Yes, sir.
My question is in the first part of verse 11, why are the daughters of Zion told to go out and gaze at King Solomon?
Because throughout the story, there's this emphasis on how Solomon is the one, you know, again, he's kind of the image, you know, what would you call, the heartthrob, to use a new word. A modern word, and they look at him with both wonder and of course they like him, but at the same time they're the observers who are learning from this song and from the events that happen.
So you don't think maybe it's his concubines and stuff?
I don't think it is. I think the daughters of Jerusalem typically is referring to young ladies of marriageable age. And throughout this story, she says, don't awaken your passions until it's the right time. Now, it will make a reference in the song to other wives. And this is, we get there, we'll deal with it. And it's the reason there's some controversy surrounding how this song could extol or exalt marriage when she's really just one among many. But we'll deal with that historical issue when we get there. But I think, you know, they're the observers. And again, it's a song, so you can imagine, even though it's a song, I always view it kind of playing out on a stage. And on the stage, there has to be an audience to watch. And the audience that watches these events unfold of Shulamit and Solomon is the chorus. And here, if there's a narrator, the narrator tells the chorus, go ahead and observe. Okay, now, let's stop there as far as not going any other verses. We'll start there next time, but let's just pause for a moment as we come to a close. What do we get from this? We've gone through three chapters pretty carefully, two today and one last time. What's the implication, or what's the application? It's not easy.
Well,
let's think about it.
One, you've got the admonition from her.
Yes. That's right. We have the admonition from her that will be repeated three different times in the book, chapter 2, chapter 3, chapter 8. The book essentially closes on that admonition, and then there's an epilogue to deal with the brothers that she had, we'll deal with them there. But it really closes with that admonition. That's not the only teaching, but that's one at the top. And you know, We get a lot of things we hear taught in conservative churches about this issue of purity, and so it should be. But just understand, this is the primary place where it's really emphasized in the whole Bible. There are, within the Old Testament law, a number of references to the issue, but I mean, this is the one place that really squarely front and center teaches about sexual purity before marriage.
And another thing here, it does seem like an elaborate stage production, but everything seems to take place, back to that appropriate time, everything seems to take place in the proper order.
That's right. This song has much a focus on timing and to some extent on person, because we really don't know if she's beautiful. We don't have a real good idea of what she looks like. But she is to him. We know what she looks like in his eyes, and we know what he looks like in her eyes. And a lot of people would argue, and I'm very open to this view, that it may not even be really Solomon in the story. Now, I'm not saying he didn't write it. What I'm saying is, you get any young couple, and they're in love like these two. He's her Solomon. She's his princess or whatever. And, you know, the imagery doesn't need to be pushed to all be literal. But the wisdom that comes out of it, the beauty of it. So here's the question. Just think of a few more things. Is the Bible running from this issue of sexuality or embracing it? Yeah, it is tackling it head on, and it's interesting. I read an interesting piece one time by a fellow that was invited to a gathering of Muslims who wanted to sort of discuss the Bible and hear his thoughts on it as a Christian, as he would try to defend it as a holy book, since they don't view the Bible as being real scripture. It would be the Quran, and this was the book they attacked, though, which is what I found fascinating, because why on earth would God talk about these things? And unfortunately, that was the view, I think, for some period of time in the church, so that churches were, and pastors were teaching this was all just a sort of allegory for, you know, Jesus loves the church. And it's clearly not what's there. Clearly not the teaching, in my view. Okay? And it just, it's a stumbling block for some that God would actually deal with this. But if you think that's unusual, read 1 Corinthians. I mean, Paul deals with marriage and remarriage and these issues just head on. And so did Jesus when asked about some of those issues. But here in particular, it's dealt with. And, I mean, the truth is, it would be a surprise if God wrote a book that claims to be sufficient for life and godliness and ignored this issue. It wouldn't make sense. It just wouldn't. The union, the romance, who's the initiator?
She is.
She is. This is difficult when we have a lot of modern scholarship that wants to paint history a little different, where women were just oppressed and all that stuff. And we know that stuff happens, and it happens today. But this reflects a relationship where that's not at all the issue. She's not oppressed. She's not being forced into a marriage, although there are those who understand the book this way, in fact.
In fact, they're more equal here. They are.
And she's pictured as the initiator. Now, some translators or some interpreters, when they see Solomon hopping over the hills and coming and looking through the lattice at her, they don't think it's Solomon. What they think is Solomon has called her into his harem against her will, and her young shepherd lover has snuck into the castle to look at her. And that's a popular interpretation. I personally don't take that one. I'm just telling you it's there. Even in that instance, it still exalts a sort of equality among them, and that the, where elsewhere sexual union is in terms of procreation and so forth, here it's cast in terms of pleasure, and it's not one-sided, and that's important. And they don't have a problem communicating with each other, do they? All right? You look at this, throughout this book, they're pretty effective communicators. This is their private conversations. We get a little peer into the window and get to hear what they say, and it's all poetic. But I'm just saying, they're good communicators. And in particular, they're communicating about this issue. And that's important. So there's a lot of practicality comes out of this. Any more thoughts or comments about practical implications of what we've seen so far? Anybody? Okay. Easy book? Hard book? People always tell me the book of Revelation is the hardest, and I always say, no. Book of Revelation is a piece of cake. Song of Solomon is a challenge. It is. But it's a rich book, and it really has a good message for us. And as we see it continue to unfold, it will paint a message that their physical romance will continue to be an enjoyable part of their marriage, even as their marriage matures. And she will come to a better understanding of why her family, and her brothers in particular, treated her the way she did when she was young. It'll kind of bring some of it full circle.